Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Zentertainment Talk Radio here on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. I'm really excited about this beautiful book called Talk Softly. I'm sitting here with Cynthia O'Neill. She goes by Cy, so I'm going to call her Cy. She was born in Los Angeles and later moved to New York City. She's lived here for many years. She modeled in Europe and in the U.S. and appeared in films, including Carnal Knowledge and Primary Colors. She was married to actor Patrick O'Neill. And this book gives you a glimpse, really, into a lot of things, into the earlier, kind of more glamorous aspects of her life in New York City, her marriage, how her path ultimately led her to help create this crisis counseling center in New York. It's a fabulous place. I want you all to know about it. It's called Friends Indeed. In this book, she shares her own stories and also the stories of people who found dignity, grace, and humor at the most difficult moments, you know, of their lives. And I think this book, like it says in the inside cover, it says it's a testament to what we can achieve when people come together with a shared purpose. Talk Softly is her story, but it's also a universal tale. So she's here today. I'm really excited to have her on the show. Thank you, Cy, so much for being here.
I'm excited to be on the show, too. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about your early years, where you grew up, and what your family was like?
It's fun to look at, for me to look at my background, because it just seems so impossible that I'd be where I am and doing what I'm doing, given my background. I grew up in California. I grew up a lot of years in the San Fernando Valley, which at the time was a valley. And I went to school on a dirt road, and there were orange groves everywhere. Whole place smelled of orange blossoms. I had every animal you could possibly have, and it was that kind of life. And but the thing that seems so different is, so strange, is my parents, like everybody, every other adult I saw, what they were doing was working to get ahead and have a good life and have a swimming pool and all of that. The things that were never mentioned to me ever were anything about service or taking care of anyone else. None of those things were anywhere in my world. Yeah. And I know sometimes, and I'm very envious of it, I talk to people. I mean, you know, my parents were wonderful. They were doing the best they could. I don't mean to make them wrong. I'm just saying it's interesting. Every now and then, you know, I talk to somebody who tells me that their families talked about helping others, giving service, what were the important things in life, what were the values you needed to have. We didn't talk about any of that in my house.
Well, I'm sure there were many parts of your childhood. You know, you couldn't write about everything in this particular book because it was also a lot about friends indeed. But one of the things you did touch on was your father's drinking problem. And I wondered, growing up with that dynamic, how did that affect you, and how did you cope with it?
Of course, when you're a kid, and particularly in those days, and this is a very long time ago, people were very, very ignorant about alcoholism. I never heard anybody talking about, well, you know, so-and-so is an alcoholic or AA or anything. That just wasn't anywhere in the world. So what I knew as a kid is if my father drank anything, it was very likely to go berserk and get very angry and maybe start throwing things around the room, and that it was awful. And so the anger was rarely directed at me. It almost never was. It was mostly at my mother and then at my younger brother. So I basically coped with it by being the one who tried to not let anything bad happen. So I would try to divert my father or get his mind off what he was angry about. I was the one who kept an eye on whether or not he, you know, his drinking. I can remember saying to my mother, don't argue with him, you should get him. So, I mean, I got a little bit in that role. And it scared me to death. I mean, because his drinking, I mean, he became violent, which he was adorable, charming, and funny otherwise. And then he would drink, and he would be this angry, white-faced, potentially violent man. So it was a real factor, and of course it set something, because I think that it's probably safe to say that any man I was ever interested in had that quality.
I find it really interesting how we repeat patterns. And I think things are passed down through so many generations, and it really takes a really strong conscious effort, if there is a pattern that's a more negative one, to stop it in its tracks. And that can be really difficult to do, can it?
What you're saying is absolutely true. And I didn't have any consciousness about any of that. I just knew that it was guys with a kind of edge of danger about them that I thought were really attractive.
Let's fast forward a little bit, maybe quite a bit. How did you get into modeling and then acting and then meet your husband, Patrick?
At the time, we lived in San Francisco, and I'd graduated from high school, and I'd gone to 1 year at Stanford, but I really wasn't interested in school, is the honest-to-God truth, because all I really wanted to do was read books, and I didn't have to go to school to read books. And suddenly, a woman that my family knew said to me, I think she worked at one of the big department stores or something, and she said to me, "Would you like to model in a fashion show?" And I go, "I guess, I don't know." And she said, "Oh, you really should, come on." So I did, and that led to being photographed a lot in San Francisco for ads in the newspapers and stuff. And then, you know, because I didn't know anything else I really wanted to do. So then the next logical step was to go to Hollywood and become an actress. I mean, it's just insane. It was not from any driving passion to be an actor or anything else. I just was bopping along thinking, oh, well, the next thing is, I guess I'll go down there and see if I can, you know, get in television or something. And I did. And that's just what I did. I went down, and very quickly I got a big part on a television show. There was a show called Matinee Theater. Every day, 5 days a week, there was an hour-length live show on NBC. An hour-length, 12 to 1, every day. And it was live, as I said, and I, you know, plunged into that. I was too dumb to know to be frightened about it. And it was actually, though the best part about that was, there were these rehearsal rooms all along a hallway and a different show in each room. And when I was doing mine in a room a couple doors down the hall, my to-be husband, Patrick O'Neill, was rehearsing in the show he was doing. And he lived in New York. And one thing led to another. And I then, of course, came back to New York with Patrick. So that's how I got here.
I think it's great to be kind of dumb about things sometimes in a way, because then what would be impossible is possible, and you end up doing something, and you did it. I mean, live TV, and you've never acted. What?
I know. I mean, just absolute moxie. I just did it, and I didn't know what else to do, so I just did it. Anyway, and then I got back to New York, which was the best thing that could ever have happened, because if anybody belonged in any city, it's me in New York. It's just my passion for New York is as strong as it was the day I got here. And so I say thank you to Patrick every day for that one.
What were some of the movies, the plays, the TV things that Patrick was in?
He was, I mean, you know, we're back in time a bit here. I mean, you know, he was in The Way We Were. So that's the period we're talking about, The Way We Were, and Castle Keep, and King Rat, and Where Were You When the Lights Were Out, and yeah, and then he did a lot of things on Broadway, and he was in Eugene O'Neill's Red Roses for Me, and he was in Freud. That was a wonderful play, and lots of things, and then he was in Night of the Iguana, and Tennessee Williams really wrote that play for him, that part for him.
You know, in one section of the book you wrote, "I had a townhouse in New York City, a lovely old Spanish house on Santa Monica Beach. My husband was at the studio filming a major movie with Redford and Streisand, and I had two beautiful, healthy sons having a wonderful time on the beach." Do you ever feel like there's certain moments, even in the middle of the messiness of all of life, where just for a few moments things are perfect?
That's very clever of you, because I'd say probably that would have been the time, as a matter of fact, then, where I think even unconscious, as I probably was a lot of the time in those days, I think I did have the wit to know that this was pretty swell, that this was pretty bloody amazing, and Patrick's career was going along. I guess I'm trying to remember, and that's funny, it's a little hard for me to remember. I don't remember if this is before his drinking got really alcoholic, or was this a period? I think it was. I think it was a period when he was in AA, and so he was sober. Because I wouldn't have been having a great time if it hadn't been part of the years that we were together that he was sober.
You had mentioned before it was more just kind of the normal social drinking. What do you think for him led it into that other place where it really became a huge problem?
I think that probably the thing that kicked it, I mean, I think that, God knows, I've been in enough rehabs, in the family part of enough rehabs and things to have learned and tend to believe that alcoholism is indeed a disease. So I think he had the disease. It was genetic. I mean, he had the genetic pieces for it. He had a grandfather who was an alcoholic. And the minute his father died, his mother became walking on her knees drunk in about a month, you know. So, you know, there was the genetic component, certainly. But I think the thing, actually, it was really the time in Night of the Iguana that kicked it. That was a very stressful time, an incredibly stressful time. Yeah, we had, you know, he had done the play as a one act at the Spoleto Festival in Italy, and it was just this wonderful triumph. It was just gorgeous. And then they came and did it at the Actor's Studio, and again, it was just, you know, talked about, and it was this wonderful thing. And then that's when Tennessee decided to make it a three-act play, and very specifically for Patrick. But everybody else got recast. Originally, it had been all members of the Actor's Studio, names that probably people may not even know, but wonderful, wonderful actors. And then the producers decided when they were doing it on Broadway that for selling tickets, they had to get some big name up there, so they cast Bette Davis in one of the two main women's parts. And that was a really disastrous decision because it just threw everything out of kilter. And she was demanding and difficult, and Patrick, I don't know, he just lost his... I mean, it's interesting because he didn't lose his center on stage. He was every bit as good, and in fact got better and better and better. But just all the internal stuff was something, and Bette Davis, he didn't know how to cope with Bette Davis. I mean, it was just, she was a steamroller. And I think, it was a very big deal. And it was all being... It was all sort of disintegrating in a way from this glorious thing it had been. And I think that's when he really, after the show, every night, he started drinking in a way he hadn't been, I'd never seen him drink before.
It had to be so scary for you. And you know, one of the things I hear over and over with a lot of the best doctors and healers is it's never one event that leads to the breakdown. And it's not, is it? It can be the cracks that, left unattended, become holes and bigger, and it usually is a great many number of things that come together in one moment.
Cracks that are unattended is a very good way to put it. Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, yes, you look back and you can say, oh yeah, well, there was that indication there, and there was that, and there was that. But you just skip along, and as you know, as a matter, I'm not being, you know, I'm not being cute. When I look back, I was profoundly unself-examining for a lot of years. Lots. I mean, I just was bopping along. I thought the whole thing was just fine. I was just dancing and having a terrific time. And then, of course, when Patrick started drinking, I mean, now the time got less wonderful, without question. But I wasn't a very aware person in those days.
Sounds nice to me right now. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of self-awareness.
Yes.
More self-examination, but at the same time, I don't know any other way to be, so I'm stuck with it.
Exactly. What else are you going to do?
You know, there's a funny story in your book. I mean, this probably doesn't have much to do with anything, but it made me laugh, so I wanted to share it with those of you listening. Is you had this cat named Chopper. Can you tell us about candles and Chopper?
That was one of the great things. One of the great animal tricks of all time. They certainly not something he was trained to do. He was a big, beautiful striped tabby cat, and for some reason, Chopper felt strongly about candles, and he just didn't want them. He didn't want them lit. So we would light a candle, and Chopper would come over and just smash it down with his paw and put it out. And the greatest example, which I did in the book, was one night that there were about 8 or 10 of us sitting around a long table, and I had put candles all the way down the table. And in our middle of dinner, Chopper jumped up on the table, started at one end, and everybody was just paralyzed. Nobody could even breathe. And he'd smash his paw down on the candle, put it out, and then he'd shake it because, of course, it was hot wax. And then he'd, when it recovered, he'd move to the next table. He went down the entire table and put them all out. And when he was finished, I mean, all the guests, everyone went mad. I mean, we were screaming and yelling and applauding and jumping up and down. It was one of the greatest animal performances I've ever seen.
I've never heard of anything so great from an animal that wasn't trained to do this. The restaurant you opened, it's renamed now, but how did, you had enough going on already. Why did you want to open a restaurant? What inspired it, and what are some of your fondest memories that you had in the early days there?
Well, that was entirely Patrick, because we lived on the Upper West Side then. He went out for a walk one day. He was just walking around, and he came back, and he said, there's something very strange. He said, Lincoln Center's almost finished. The buildings are, you know, they're in the last stages. It's going to be open soon. It's going to be thousands of people there every night. And I can't help but notice that there aren't, I don't see anybody doing any new restaurants. I don't see anybody doing a restaurant. And there were a couple of old neighborhood restaurants that were around, but that's, so then he went for another walk and he came back and he said, there's this empty garage on 64th Street right across from Lincoln Center, and it's for rent. For $465 a month. And so then we sat around and started saying, God, wouldn't it be fun? Wouldn't it be fun? We could just do this little perfect restaurant, you know? And then his younger brother had just come to New York trying to figure out what he was going to do with his life. Anyway, we did it. We did it. We called it the Ginger Man because Patrick was in the play of that name at the time, and we loved the name because it felt mysterious. Nobody knew what a ginger man was. Anyway, and then it was a glory in the early days. It just unbelievably great because it was only 60 seats, and all the artists came. And when they finished performances across the street and everything, I mean, that's where they went. There wasn't anywhere else to go. So we would sit there. And I remember Patrick and I would a lot sit at the bar and have something to eat and drink champagne. And, you know, there they all were. There was Leonard Bernstein and George Balanchine and the stars from the opera. I mean, it was about as swell as anything could be. It was great. It was absolutely great. And later on, because it expanded and it got bigger and it became more and more a place where then tourists coming into New York came, which was fine. I mean, that's we needed them to come too. But it was those early days when it was all kind of family, when it was sort of just the inside of the art world. That was really exciting.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the day that John Lennon was shot.
Well, that was a deciding event in my life for sure. He, first of all, as everybody in my, particularly my generation, not limited to my generation, but certainly everybody in my generation, we were all just nuts about the Beatles, and I was particularly nuts about John Lennon. I thought he's who gave the Beatles their edge. He was the one that had a little danger about him. So of course I'd like him. Anyway, I was crazy about him. And one of the great things about living in the Dakota was that I was living in the same building John Lennon was in, which is just felt like some glorious thing had been achieved. I'm not sure what, but anyway, we were there, we were. And I would see him in the elevator from time to time. And I just loved him. And so then came that night, that early evening. And I was home, and I heard the shots, and as I wrote about, my son came running in the room and saying those were gunshots, and I said, oh, don't be silly, of course they're not. And then he came back and he said, I was right, and John Lennon was shot. And it just At first, I didn't even want to believe it. I just didn't want to believe it. But it became clear rather quickly that indeed that is what had happened and that indeed he had died. And it was astounding because what happened in the Dakota was really, on one level, so interesting. I mean, so fascinating because there were thousands of people outside in just in a blink. People just came. They just wanted to be as close as they could get, and the streets were filled with people. And the Dakota closed down because they didn't want media getting in. They didn't want anybody. It was like living in a police state. You could not be in there unless you lived there. And I remembered seeing Chapman standing outside. Because he'd been outside for 2 or 3 days, standing by the entrance before he killed Dunnan, and it was just this surreal time, and as I've said, it also ruined the Dakota for me. I never loved being there anymore. I thought living in the Dakota was just the best thing you could do in New York City, but not after that. Not after that. So we were there a couple more years, but it never felt great to me anymore because that's all I could think about when I walked in and when I walked out. And yeah, it was such a devastating loss.
At first, it sounded like it was this very loving outpouring of response from, well, of course, all of you in the building, but the thousands of people who descended upon the entrance and in the area. But then you said it became a lot of people who were kind of seeking celebrity for themselves for a minute. That must have been horrible.
It was terrible. It was just awful. Yeah, they're out there, and there's a lot of empty beer cans and people yelling. And then when the media'd be there, people rushing to shove their faces in front of the camera. And yeah, that was awful.
Did you ever imagine that all that came before would lead you to doing the work you do now?
Not at all. Not at all. And there's one mysterious element, because certainly I was starting to, you know, the AIDS epidemic was upon us. And certainly if your friends are all in the arts and theater, etc., you're very likely to start knowing people, or at least certainly knowing of people who were infected with the virus. Okay. So there was all that going on. But the big, you know, the deciding factor was the day that I decided to go to a workshop, a weekend workshop. I read about it. I don't even know how I knew about it. A weekend workshop that this woman from California, Louise Hay, was leading for people with AIDS. And why did I have to be in that room? I don't really know that. I can't explain that. But boy, I was driven. The minute I heard about it, I signed up for it. And I just was absolutely moved to be in that room. I wanted to be, I just was so interested and moved and touched by, because they were all so young. That factor was just so affecting to me, that we're talking, you know, they're 22 and 25 and 19 and 30 and everything, and they've got this, at the time, what was being diagnosed as an absolutely fatal illness. There's no way out, no cure. And something made me want to be in the room with those people and see how they were handling that. What were they doing? Anyway, that was it. I mean, that was the best. That was the great thing I did, because everything, that changed it all. That was after that moment, that was the main thing in my life, was the AIDS epidemic. So now I'm meeting more and more people who have the virus. And I began to see something. I began to see, what I saw is driven by two things, really. New York City, as is San Francisco particularly, but other big cities, but certainly New York, was a place that housed hundreds of young gay people who came from the towns, the small towns, particularly of the Midwest and the South, where they did not feel welcome, where they were judged and criticized and told there was something wrong with them, and quite rightly, they got out and came to New York City. Okay. So now they have this virus, and they don't have any family around them. And in fact, and I had great compassion for the families too. I would think about, all right, what is it like? You're living a little, probably dominantly religious right community in Arkansas. And everybody, first of all, thinks that being gay is a choice. They don't know that it isn't. And they're being told in their churches that it's an abominable sin. Okay. So they get a phone call, and they find out two things in one phone call. Their kid's gay, which I think mostly they had never admitted to themselves, because I think it's hard to believe that parents don't know that their kid is gay. But I think there were cases where they really didn't know. So, all right, so in the same phone call, they find out their kid is gay, and they have at the time, a fatal illness. Okay. A lot of them. There were ones who absolutely came running and were fabulous, but a lot of them absolutely could not handle any of that. It was just not something they could cope with on any level. And a lot of them never even came. They never even came. And so, you know, I saw that. So for one thing, I thought, what the people in the gay community who were HIV positive had, which was each other, and that was very powerful. I mean, I saw people who were ill themselves taking care of their friend who was more ill, in the most beautiful and magnificent way. I mean, they were teachers. So that was one factor. These people need a lot of support is needed here that they haven't got in their lives. The other factor was in this insane culture we live in, where death is considered a failure. Death is so terrible that a lot of people can't even talk about it. So I would be in hospital rooms, and I would see the families who did come from Arkansas or elsewhere, and their young son lying on the bed was clearly dying, and they're standing around talking about when he's going to get well and how great it's going to be, and just so much fear in the room. And I didn't see anybody's. I saw so rarely a bed surrounded by people saying, "It's okay. I love you. It's fine. You're doing great." No, I saw them hysterical, trying to hang on, saying absolutely insane things, you know. And I thought, there has got to be a place where people can go, get support, and where they can talk about death and dying not as a terrible catastrophe, not as a failure, but as what is naturally going to happen to every one of us, and we can all talk about it. We can join together and talk about it. So I said all this at lunch one day with my friend Mike Nichols, and Mike just got it immediately. And I said, there's got to be a place for people. And Mike said, I have really been feeling I had to do something, but I haven't known what to do. And he said, you just told me. So we just went to work immediately. And in about 3 months, we had Friends Indeed open.
In the early days of the organization, you had written a little bit about Marianne Williamson was involved. And I guess maybe Louise Hay, well, she was the first workshop, I guess, that you went to. But how did your approach to helping people heal differ with some of the ideas from Things and A Course in Miracles and some of that kind of thing?
You know, there's a lot of good stuff in Course in Miracles, and there's And certainly Marianne did a lot of, you know, she did a lot of good work. There was one place that I just had a big problem with from the get-go, and that was the place that Marianne quoted a lot, that it said in the Course in Miracles, the only things that exist are things that are of love and of God. And although if it's not of love and God, it isn't even exist. Well, and then following up with, AIDS is not of God and of love, so it doesn't even exist. Well, there's nowhere to work with that as far as I'm concerned. I just, that just didn't work for me. That just didn't work for me at all. And I thought we will do better if we work from the place of AIDS is something very real and it does exist. And now that it's here, how do we do the very best we can with it?
I love that. And I also agree with you, but that could be a whole nother show. But sometimes the things that go, that earlier organization, the way it was grouped, somebody else came in that was working above you and it didn't work out so well, but it led you to what Friends Indeed really is now. And I was thinking about in my own life, and maybe many of you listening, sometimes the things that don't work out like we want them to are the springboards for where we're supposed to go.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's the ultimate, the Zen monk and the sun, right? We'll see. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. That when he was given a horse and everybody thought it was wonderful, and he said, "We'll see." And the son broke his arm. What a terrible thing. We'll see. Everything is we'll see. And it's absolute. I just, and in 20 years of leading groups at Friends Indeed, you just hear it constantly. The thing somebody thought was going to be the wonderful thing turns out not to be so wonderful. The thing that people thought was a disaster at first was the bad news, turns out to be the moment where everything shifted and wonderful things happened. So we don't know. We just don't know what's the good news and what's the bad news. One of the quotes that I just love most, and I've used a million times in groups at Friends, is there's a very wise man. I think actually he's a psychiatrist, but he had a real tragedy in his life. A wife and a daughter killed in a plane crash that he saw. I mean, about as bad as it gets. And many years later, he said that, we are all so busy trying to be happy that we fail to notice that it is catastrophe that reorders our lives in wondrous ways.
And it's true, too. I think that you notice things in a completely different way, on completely different levels, when you have a catastrophe happen. And that's really what it feels like, a catastrophe. I mean, there's no sugarcoating it and saying, oh, this is a blessing right now. No.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I know, I mean, in any group at Friends Indeed, it's very possible that somebody is just newly diagnosed and they're just, you know, hysterical, frantic, frightened. And somebody else in the room who has been, has had AIDS for years, will say, we hear it all the time, the truth of the matter is, getting AIDS, or it can be someone talking about cancer, whatever, getting AIDS was the best thing that ever happened to me. And then there'll be someone who's just diagnosed, or they're just thinking, oh, please, what are you talking about, you know? What Hallmark card nonsense is that? Just wait. And there are so many people that would say that, especially because so many people were leading very thoughtless lives before they got a diagnosis, and they were really headed down a very self-destructive path, and this is what snapped them to. And it forced them to start taking care of themselves, examining their lives, making all kinds of changes, so that now the quality of their life was 1,000 times better than it had been or would have been if they hadn't gotten the virus.
And for some people, maybe physically the quality of life is much worse. Everybody's situation is so different, but there's other things that come to life. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Friends Indeed. Now, who is this open to? Is this open to people with any life-threatening illnesses and caregivers, and what is offered there?
Yeah, now we expanded. I mean, at first we were all about AIDS. But then what started to happen in a very organic way is people with AIDS started bringing in friends who were dealing with cancer because they got it that what was happening there would be the same for them. I mean, it would be hopeful for them as well. So in a very organic way, other people started coming. So really whom we serve is people dealing with any life-threatening illness, caregivers, and grief and bereavement. Those are our subjects. And the heart of the place are these groups that we call the big groups. And that's where everybody comes together. And we have groups where some of the groups are focused on, we just say focused, because anybody can come to them dealing with whatever. But maybe one group will be focused on HIV, another one will be focused on cancer, another will be focused on caregiving, because what we discovered is, while we love everybody in the same room, because when you put everybody together, then people in time begin to see that it's all the same, that there aren't categories, that there aren't definitions. Here we all are, you know, with whatever we're dealing with. But it helps people sometimes on the outside who think that they need to be in a room who have exactly the same thing that they have. And so it makes it easier for them to walk through the door.
No matter what the diagnosis, I think there are things, well, yeah, there's normal things that everybody has in common, these human reactions of the fear, the anxiety of how do I deal with these new limitations or deal with physically feeling what I'm feeling. Those are things that are common to a wide range of things. And within every diagnosis, there's also people that are highly functioning and people that can't even move. You know, you get the whole gamut. But I think that coming together, and like you said, like combining all the different things, it makes you realize what you have in common, and you can deal with it from that place, and it helps a little bit with the isolation.
Absolutely. Well, we always have that choice. Do we want to organize ourselves around our similarities or organize ourselves around our differences? And we're very much, obviously, about similarities. And, I mean, a perfect example, I don't even remember I frequently can't remember what I put in the book and what I didn't. But anyway, a perfect example was one night I was about to go into the big group to start the Tuesday night meeting, and there was a woman standing in the doorway that I'd never seen before, and I said hello to her, and I said, you coming in? And she said, well, I don't think I'm going to, because this is obviously, this is mostly men, and they're dealing with AIDS, and I have breast cancer, and it's entirely different. And I said, okay, well, and how do you feel about having breast cancer? And she said, I'm terrified. And so there was a young man who had recently been diagnosed with AIDS standing very nearby, and I called him over and I introduced them, and I asked him how he felt when he found out he was HIV positive, and he said, oh, I'm terrified. So he used the same word, and it was good. I mean, she got it. I said, I see the two of you have everything in common, because this is not a place where we're talking about your prescriptions. You know, which is a valuable thing to talk about, but it's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is the emotional, spiritual part of this, of being sick. And whether you have AIDS or whether you have cancer, it doesn't matter. If you're frightened, you're frightened. And that's what we're here to talk about.
In the book, there was a woman named Pam, and she kind of pressed your buttons. And I love that you wrote about her, because it made me realize how sometimes people we meet are re-triggering earlier events. And I wondered how meeting her and knowing her helped you heal a part of yourself.
Pam looked exactly like those girls in high school that I always had a hard time with. And I was always the one who had done the wrong thing or said the wrong thing or wore the wrong thing or something. I had a very hard time in high school. I thought it was a nightmare. And she looked exactly like those San Mateo high school girls in little sweater sets and a single strand of pearls and all that. That's what Pam looked like. And also when she first came in, she was mostly just very sorry for herself. And the guys weren't, for the most part. I didn't hear a lot of that kind of, and she kept saying, all I ever wanted was a normal life. And I kept saying, what's that? And she said, well, you know, I just want to be married and have a husband and children, and now I'm going to die. And it was all, I mean, anyway, my initial reaction to her was transformed, you know, 180 degrees, because the more I got to know her, the more time I spent with her, I saw how incredibly caring and loving she was about her family and her friends, and in fact, what a warrior she was. And by the time Pam died, I just adored her. And she was a great teacher for me. She was a great teacher because the leap beyond immediate first impression was enormous.
Sometimes it goes the opposite way, too. Well, the energy that you have around you is fabulous, but also I have to tell you, you are like almost a twin to one of my very best friends who was older than you. She died a few years ago at the age of 92, so she was older, but you remind me so much of her. So sometimes it works the opposite, and you connect with someone because they remind you of somebody else.
I know, so you bring all that good stuff with, you know. That's why, you know, we say it, friends, all the time. The truth is, we don't see anything. I think it's in the Torah. It says that we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. You know. So you look at me, and your filter, your lens, has in it a loved friend. So what has it got to do with me? Absolutely nothing. Nothing, and nothing has to, nothing ever has to do with anything, right? I mean, nothing. It's always personal. It's always out of our history, out of our story. How we have the world wired together is how we see everything.
Sometimes you can fall for somebody or a guy who, you know, winks or has a certain look that reminds you of an ex-boyfriend or someone you liked, and he might be miserable, this new guy, and horrible.
Oh, absolutely. Nothing to discuss. Oh, it can be a tiniest little thing, something about the corner of the mouth, and you're just madly in love. And you think it's insane. No, but it's exactly how it goes. We don't see anything. We don't see things clearly, cleanly. How could we? We can't. We can't. Because our own filter, which is an accumulation of every experience we've ever had since we've been on the planet, is how we view things. So that's why we are ever saying to people, people get upset about something someone said to them or how they treat me. It's not personal. It can't be personal. It's not even about you. It's always about them.
It's such a great lesson and such a great reminder, just talking about it and being aware of that, reminding ourselves that we see things as we are and not necessarily as they are. I wanted to ask you one or two last questions. So friends, indeed, from here, what is your vision for the future? How do you see it? What does the organization need right now? How can we help and get involved?
Well, the organization, given the world we live in, of course, always needs financial help. I mean, just always, always, always. And we use up too much of our time and energy and resources in raising money to keep the doors open. And, you know, and we do it gladly because we think that what we're doing there is so important. I have a big vision, and we've been talking more and more about this lately. Friends Indeed should not be only in New York City. It's ridiculous because we are a particular, what we do there, the work we do there, the way we hold death, dying, caregiving, grief, the way it's just not, you can't find, there aren't other places that are looking at it that way. There's wonderful support in this country. Generally, it's very focused in on one thing. You know, there is the group for women with breast cancer. You know, a lot of support is around the idea that, oh, this is a really terrible thing, but we'll somehow get through it together. And we don't feel that. We see it all as possibility. You know, the basic mandate of Friends Indeed is that we are there supporting each other in taking whatever shows up in our lives and using it to become richer, more compassionate human beings. That's what we're there to do. So we don't look at anything as a disaster. Do you know? And there's a big difference between, you know, for most people, out in their personal lives, they tell their family or friends and they say, I just found out I have cancer. And the reaction is kind of, oh my God, oh, terrible, you know. They walk through the door of Friends Indeed and they said, I just found out I have cancer. And we say, ah, okay, how you doing? What do we need to do? Totally acknowledging how how upsetting it is, totally, but not treating it like something so dreadful that it, all that does is accelerate and exacerbate the fear. We're not afraid of those things at Friends Indeed. We're very calm about them and accepting about them and loving about them. Now, I'd like, I just think this is work that needs to be in many more places. And we're just trying to, we're sort of looking at how to do that. I mean, the ideal would be, because you can't just go do it. The ideal would be somebody wants to do it in Chicago, open one in Chicago, is that people who would want to do that come to New York and spend a couple months with us. Come sit in on the groups. We'll train you. We'll just support you. We'll come visit you in Chicago. We'll do whatever we need to do. But we can't all leave and go to Chicago to do it. We just can't do it. Can't do that. But I certainly can support anybody who's interested in doing it wherever they are.
What's the website for Friends Indeed? And also, where can people find out about your book?
Friendsindeed.org, O-R-G. And everything's on there, including Talk Softly. There's also...
It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show, to talk to you. Just really wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
I've had such a nice time talking to you. Thank you very much. A real pleasure.
This is Entertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.centertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. That was Cynthia O'Neill. Her new book is called Talk Softly. It's absolutely wonderful. You can get it at friendsindeed.org or at your local bookstore. Thank you so much for joining us, and it's been great to talk to Cynthia and all of you. Catch you next time. Peace.